Hey, Christian, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How worried are you personally that Chinese hackers are going to strike U.S. critical infrastructure?
That's a good question. I think, honestly, if it gets to that point, I'm more worried that we would be in a war with China rather than specifically China using cyber to attack critical infrastructure. If we get to that point, we're going to have a lot of concerns besides that as well, essentially.
That's a very wise answer. So we're going to be talking a bit about Chinese operations against U.S. critical infrastructure today and how the industrial cybersecurity community feels about those operations and how they're preparing for them. We've also got an interview today with Sherrod DiGrippo, who leads Microsoft's threat intelligence operation, about how state-backed hackers are targeting AI systems. That's coming up on Safe Mode.
Welcome to Safe Mode. I'm Elias Grohl, Senior Editor at CyberScoop. Every week, we break down the most pressing issues in technology, provide you the knowledge and the tools to stay ahead of the latest threats, and take you behind the scenes of the biggest stories in cybersecurity.
An attack is coming.
It's about keeping us safe.
He's just a disgruntled hacker.
She's a super hacker. Stay alert.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
This is Safe Mode.
I'm Elias Grohl, the host of Safe Mode, and I'm joined today by CyberScoop reporter Christian Vasquez. Welcome back to the show, Christian.
Hey, hey.
So you recently had the hardship assignment of having to go to Miami to hang out with some industrial cybersecurity folks for the big annual S4 gathering of industrial cybersecurity pros. What did you learn? What was the vibe?
The vibe was we were on South Beach, so the vibe was great.
Great.
Besides that, I think when it comes to China and Volt Typhoon, which is the Chinese hacking operations that the intelligence community has been worrying about in recent weeks and months, it was essentially, yes, of course, China is doing that. We do that too. Every nation state worth its salt targets critical infrastructure. Now, that's not saying they're not really taking it seriously, but they just wanted more information as to why now the IC is kind of saying all this, because this is, to them, not necessarily new.
Yeah, so we should back up the tape a little bit here and say that for anyone who's been paying attention to cybersecurity issues in Washington over the last couple of weeks, we've had a drumbeat of warnings from U.S. intelligence officials that Chinese hackers are targeting U.S. critical infrastructure, that they're pre-positioning assets on a variety of critical infrastructure entities to be able to disable those entities in the event of a crisis. Now, the folks that you were hanging out with in Miami, they're the folks who are supposed to be protecting those systems against these types of operations. And I'm maybe a little bit surprised at them shrugging their shoulders.
I don't know if shrugging their shoulders is exactly the right term, because I don't want to like overstate that they're kind of yeah, whatever about this. It's more that they kind of operate with that assumption, right? For them, critical infrastructure are lives at stake. That's the water you're drinking, the energy you need for, you know, that you need, that hospital needs, that everyone else needs as well. So it's not, they're kind of like, yeah, we know, but can you give us more information? Just saying that China is targeting critical infrastructure writ large, and I think it was like energy, telecoms, water, drinking water, satellites were all targeted by this group. That's great. Thank you. But kind of what else do you have? Like, can you give us a little bit more specifics? And I think one quote by someone who works at Clarity actually said this really, a quote in the story that says this really clear, that I think really really shows what they're talking about. It's not that they're taking it seriously, but seriousness requires specificity. And I think that kind of sums up a lot of people's responses. Now, not everyone thought that. There was some folk who just said that, you know, the ICS industrial community has essentially, they might be, you know, a bit, they might be used to the threat. And so they might not be taking it as seriously now as they should, right? And so it's a little bit of back and forth. It's a little bit of nuanced conversation, but essentially they just want a little bit more information from the IC, because this is a long-standing problem with the IC, right? They give information and the private sector wants more. So it's nothing totally new, but At the same time, they want more.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, this is an old story. I was up at Fort Meade on Friday for a reporter roundtable with Rob Joyce, the head of the NSA cybersecurity director, who's about to retire. And when he was looking back at his time in the agency and was reflecting on the work that he's done, one of the things that, you know, he cited as being top of mind and in terms of kind of the positive things that he's been able to do is trying to get the agency to share more. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that he puts it is, what's sensitive is not always what we know, but rather how we know it. Mm-hmm. And what we know is useless unless we put it in the hands of people who can actually do something about it. Mm-hmm. And that reality is reflected, I think, or that thinking is reflected in the advisories that the government has been putting out on these issues. Mm-hmm. The government is clearly trying to get better at these things,
right.
And still industry is really dissatisfied with the products, the information that they're getting from the government. Like, what is it that they want?
I mean, in some points, and I heard this from a couple of people, just, well, if they're there, where are they? And can you point them out to us? And can you get them out, right? That's on one hand. But I will kind of say back to your point, it's interesting because most of the critical infrastructure in the United States is owned by the private sector, right? That's very commonly known. I mean, the estimates are, you know, 80% to 90%, whatever. We actually don't know, but it's that high. We don't actually have a lot of monitoring for the operational technology, which is more the technology that does the physical thing, that measures the pressure of the steam, that, you know, switches the electricity to go from one way to another way. We actually don't have a lot of monitoring in that. So, you know, the IC may know that this is happening, but they actually may not know where. And that's really, I think, a kind of underappreciated point, because if China is targeting critical infrastructure within the U.S., right, not in like Hawaii or any kind of other place that has military bases, that probably has a bit more monitoring than, you know, your average civilian water facility, that it's going to be hard to find them. It's going to be hard to get them out, because a lot of these utilities just don't have the ability to actually see them in the first place. So that's kind of a weird conflict, right? That not a lot of people are talking about. In many areas, we just don't see much there. So they might not see it either.
And I think it bears emphasizing also that one of the reasons why we don't know where the Chinese operations are is that they've gotten a lot better.
Yes.
They've gotten a lot better. Mm-hmm. They're much stealthier. They're using these so-called living off the land tools to carry out their operations. And they're difficult to spot now.
Right. And so back in 2012, CISA's predecessor, which is called the National Protection of Programs Directorate, issued an alert about hackers going into 23 different U.S. pipelines, right? And this was China. This was attributed to be China later. They kind of reissued the alert actually shortly after the Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack, interesting enough, but...
Which was not carried out by China.
Which was not China. That was, you know, some Russian ransomware who kind of got a little bit over their head, right? Mm-hmm. So that campaign, however, was very obvious, right? That was spear phishing campaigns. They were actually calling people up and trying to say, hey, can you tell us your security practices? We're doing a survey for whatever made up company. It's a very, very loud thing to do. And if you have random people calling you, asking you for your security services, you're probably going to be a little bit suspicious. So that was very loud. And now with Volt Typhoon, you know, you hear that this is kind of their best, right? This is, they're good at stealth. They're good at access. They're good at maintaining that access. So it just makes it all the more difficult to find it in a place where we don't have the greatest visibility in the first place.
Yeah. One of the other big takeaways from that conversation with Rob Joyce last Friday that I was at was that the U.S. government is still finding victims of this Volt Typhoon campaign. Mm-hmm. They don't know the scope of it. And they're still getting their arms around the shape of the problem.
Yeah, and I think there's two ways that there's two main ways, there might be others, that cyber physical attacks on critical infrastructure could have an impact. One is to, you know, influence military objectives like deployments, or, you know, cut off electricity that serves a certain military site. That's one of them. That's a major concern. ICS said that military bases were targeted by Volt Typhoon. The other part is really just public panic.
Yeah.
And that's something that happens pretty much any time critical infrastructure gets hit. I mean, Aliquippa with the Cyber Avengers kind of hacking group did a very, very low effort thing where they just got a PLC and they put some scary messaging on it, right? People freaked out about that. Colonial Pipeline, kind of going back to that, led to long lines at the gas stations because, again, people were worried that they're not going to have gas. That's, I think, an underappreciated problem as well, because the threat vector in critical infrastructure is very large. Wider facilities are becoming more digitized. The energy sector writ large is becoming more digitized. We have, you know, electric vehicle chargers. We have all this new kind of digitally native equipment that, if China really wants to, they can kind of just go into one of those, create enough noise, and possibly impact public perception.
That's the future we have to look forward to. Let's end it on that very positive note. Christian Vasquez, thanks for coming back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up next on Safe Mode, I'm joined by Sherrod DiGrippo, who leads Microsoft's threat intelligence operation. If you're a person on the internet today, you've probably experimented a bit with large language models. State-backed hacking groups are just as curious about tools like ChatGPT, and Sherrod DiGrippo joins the show to talk about how Microsoft has seen Russia and China's elite hackers use AI models. When ChatGPT debuted in the fall of 2022, it set the internet ablaze and opened many people's eyes to the capabilities of a new generation of machine learning technology. It also caught the attention of some of the world's most sophisticated hackers. And for the companies developing leading-edge models, preventing hackers from misusing them now represents a key challenge. To discuss that issue, I'm joined today by Sherrod DiGrippo, the Director of Threat Intelligence Strategy at Microsoft. Sherrod, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So about a month ago, Microsoft and OpenAI, not you personally, but Microsoft and OpenAI put out a report describing how state-backed hackers from China, Iran, North Korea, and Russia, kind of the big four, are using OpenAI models. And I kind of wanted to kick off this discussion, maybe for listeners who might not be familiar with that report. What did you find? Like, how are hackers from these states, conventionally seen as the most capable, besides maybe Israel and the US, are using these models?
Well, I think a good place to start is the origin of why would we check into that research, right? We were constantly getting discussions and questions from customers and enterprises and governments and organizations saying, hey, AI is being used by everyone. People are using it to do everything from build their music playlists to recipes and shopping lists. What are threat actors doing with it? Obviously, Microsoft has a significant amount of AI tools for defenders, but what are the threat actors doing? And that was really the origin of getting into a report like this. And so we did work with our partners at OpenAI. We're fantastic, and we're very pleased and grateful for that partnership. And we said, hey, like, let's dig into some attributed actors that we think might be using AI. And we found that the big four, as you said, North Korea, Russia, Iran, and China, all were leveraging AI in some way.
So how are they using these tools? One of the kind of baseline takeaways from the report, as I read it, was that they're experimenting with these tools, but they're not quite using them to maybe carry out attacks. Like, let's get into like a little bit of the nitty-gritty. Like, what are they actually concretely using these models for?
I think that's right. What we're seeing is a very early stage use of a powerful and widely available tool, which I think you could also say about a regular person using a regular AI tool to do some shopping or pull up a recipe. So I believe from what we found, AI as a tool is being leveraged in a very early stage by these nation-sponsored threat actor groups. And they're largely leveraging it for things like research, understanding where they might want to dig in deeper, filling in gaps of knowledge that they don't have, understanding, hey, what does this mean? Who is this person? What is this technology? How does it work? So they're asking questions that generally look like research. But then when you combine it with the attribution of coming from a threat actor, the implications could be potentially different.
Mm. It almost sounds like they're using them like a productivity tool, like any other enterprise user.
I think
almost.
That's right.
Yeah.
But other enterprises are producing things like breakfast cereals and consumer electronics, and the things that these nation state threat actor groups produce are obviously cyber threats to security.
Yeah. So was there anything about how these hacking groups are using the models that kind of surprised you or stood out to you?
It stood out to me that they were quite blatant in trying to leverage AI for their primary mission. And I also think to a degree, it's somewhat expected. I use all kinds of LLM applications all day in my personal and work life. Threat actors would, of course. And I think that that in many ways was the hypothesis before anyone even really started digging into it, is it's highly likely that threat actors, they're just like us, and they are leveraging this technology and tool in their day-to-day life.
Yeah, the threat actors are just like us. That feels like a...
They're not just like
a good tagline for a lot of our conversations on this podcast, actually, in many ways. Anyway. So one of my favorite examples from the report was the group known as ABT-28, Fancy Bear. This is one of the elite Russian hacking groups, a group that was involved in a lot of the more interesting and perhaps impactful attacks in 2016 on the U.S. election. And they used the LLMs, as you observe them, trying to understand satellite communication protocols, radar imaging technologies, and specific technical parameters. Can you talk us through what you saw in that example and how you interpret that activity?
I can't give a lot of examples around exactly what those queries looked like and things, but I think that the overall picture that we're seeing there is threat actors are trying to fill in their knowledge gaps. And I think you can infer that when we talk about the big four APT countries, they do have significant sanctions on them. And when a country has a sanctioned daily life, a sanctioned reality where they can't get access to certain things and certain information, that they're going to try and figure out how they can do that in other ways and get around that. I think that kind of searching is very alarming, obviously, because I don't believe that it's going to just kind of be the end of it. We're going to do a little research and that's it. Obviously, this is some sort of capability that they want to investigate more. They want to understand more. And so while we're still at that early stage of threat actors using AI tools, we won't be at that stage forever.
I'm wondering how you approach like the classic intelligence dilemma with something like this, where you can sit and just observe what the Russians are doing for a long time and not cut them off from, you know, using these models, right? And you can just observe and learn and watch what they're doing. And by watching what they're doing, you can learn a great deal about what they're interested in, maybe about what they're planning to do. The research about satellite systems is an interesting one, right? Because we've seen Russian groups target satellite systems before. Perhaps this is an indication that they're going to do so again or in some new and novel way. What's the trigger point for you when you step in and say, you know what, all right, we've had enough of what these groups are doing and we're going to cut off their access?
Well, so in this case, we did cut off access to all of the groups that we saw leveraging the technology for that purpose. That said, I think any activity that you can attribute to a known threat actor is likely to not be a legitimate use of those systems. And in this case, we did work with OpenAI to disable any access that these particular threat actor groups had to these tools. And that's what we will continue to do. We will continue to work with our partners, and we will continue to follow responsible AI principles, and we will continue to cut off access to threat actors to every possible thing. I want to be very clear, not just to AI tools. Microsoft is committed to cutting off access for threat actors anywhere and everywhere that they might go. And so AI is one piece of that, but there is a variety of other places where if we see threat actor activity, we will stop it. And that's the point. So it just kind of expands that tooling ground. I think that ultimately Microsoft's number one priority is protecting people and protecting those systems and protecting organizations. And we do that by cutting off that access where we see it.
I think one of the things that folks listening to this podcast will be interested in is, you know, we're frequent consumers of threat intelligence products and trying to understand what state-backed hacking groups are up to. And it seems like, in my mind at least, it seems like an interesting problem in trying to figure out how to tie existing APT groups to their use of large language models. I'm curious how you make the link between a user's use of an OpenAI model and an existing set of malicious cyber activity that you probably know in a quite different domain. Like, how do you tie queries to an OpenAI model to a group like APT28, for example, which is, you know, best known for work not touching OpenAI systems at all?
Sure. So ultimately, even with something like this OpenAI partnership, the methods and procedures and tradecraft of adversary attribution remain the same. So we don't really use new types or new kinds of attribution. We already have that attribution done, and we continue to follow the same attribution tradecraft that we've always done. And in this case, it just happened to apply to use of AI systems that are part of the OpenAI partnership agreement and partnership relationship. But we'll continue to do attribution in the same way. I don't think that AI actually, you know, I could be wrong here because this is very projecting and sort of, you know, predictions looking ahead. And I don't know that AI is going to drastically change the way in which or the points leveraged to do attribution. I think it will make it faster. I think attribution will become much faster with the use of AI tools. I don't think that the way attribution is done is going to drastically change. And we didn't change it for this.
When a hacking group like APT28 is pinging an OpenAI model, is it easy for you to figure out that's APT28? Are they dumb enough to be like accessing the model through some IP address where you know, like, oh, that's Dmitry in Moscow. We know you.
Yes, and we know it to that granularity.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. So I think, you know, I think that they're probably not super concerned about getting caught, because ultimately what they're doing is just using the tool.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's a whole lot to say on like how that all works, but we want to stop threat actors from using that kind of stuff and try to cut off access as we can.
Yeah. So I think when the report dropped, a lot of folks were pretty amazed at the granularity of some of the information that was in the report. I mean, you have, I forget whether there are direct quotes in the report or not, but you have, you know, detailed descriptions of spear phishing emails that are being read. And I don't know if you saw this, but the technologist Bruce Schneier wrote a blog post afterwards, after the report came out, saying that Microsoft is spying on its users in order to be able to have this information. And it's clear from the report, right, that you do have access to a lot of user data in order to be able to write a report like this. I'm curious if you could kind of respond to that idea of kind of Microsoft security spying on its users in order to figure out who's using their models and how they're being used. Like, how would you respond to that criticism?
Sure. So this is not a case of users. This is a case of pre-attributed threat actors that we had already been tracking. As you can tell from the report, these are tried and true, old school. These are names that you know, threat actors. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really important to understand, is that this was attribution that we already had that was a focus of research on these particular threat actors and what their particular TTPs were and, you know, what they might be in the future. So while I hugely respect Bruce and for 20 years have really followed a lot of his guidance, I think he misses the mark here. This is not about user data. This is about pre-attributed threat actors that all of us in the threat intelligence community are already tracking.
Right. So I want to get into a little bit some of the spear phishing component of this. The, you know, one of the key risks that AI researchers have identified with large language model proliferation and increasing capability is that these models are going to be used to create more and better spear phishing emails. I'm wondering whether you think that you see that risk playing out in your monitoring of these LLM systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important thing to think about. If anyone who's kind of followed my trajectory thinks about it, I spent the past, 8 years doing email and securing email. And
that sounds like it was a really fun experience.
You know, I can recite RFC 822 from heart now. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but I can look at a header and tell you exactly what's up.
Great.
I think that here's what's interesting about email and phishing in general is that it comes with a story. No matter what that story may be, social engineering comes with a story. Now, let's say I have an exploit on an edge device, and I exploit that edge device, and I get in that router, and I pop from there all through that network. There's no emotional pull. There's no urgency. There's no story.
Mm.
It's an exploit applied to a vulnerability, and I'm in it.
Yeah.
Now, if I have an email, I'm going to make you cry. I'm going to make you scream. I'm going to make you happy. I'm going to make you sad. I'm going to make you make purchases. I'm going to make you call people. It's so human. And I think that's why thinking about email as a vehicle is so compelling. It has the story. It has the drama that comes with it. And I will even posit that social engineering doesn't work unless you have an emotional angle to it. You can't get someone to take this action unless you put them in an emotional state that they were not in before. So when we think about threat actors leveraging social engineering via email, augmented by artificial intelligence, the number one thing we have to do there is improve the AI tools that defenders have access to be able to detect and block those threats. That's the way we're going to win this. It's to have better, more scaled, more deployed AI tools than the threat actors do, which I think at this time we do. I don't see threat actors blowing my mind with their uses of AI. I do see things that Microsoft and others are releasing that really impress me, that have true value to defenders and especially have true value to decision makers who can say, we want to put resources here, we want to focus on this, we want to defend ourselves in these ways, because AI has allowed them to accelerate their decision making and resource usage. Phishing will always be near and dear to my heart because it is highly dramatic and I love a story. That said, I think that we can really, really, really defend well with the AI tools that we see coming online.
Okay, so yeah, I want to ask you then about like spear phishing detection. If I ask a model to like explicitly generate a spear phishing email, like that's a really easy reject by the model. I ask it for spear phishing, it sees spear phishing. It's like, I'm not doing spear phishing, Elias. I won't write this email for you. But if I ask a model to write an email to a North Korean focused researcher referencing an attachment that I'm going to include a malicious piece of code in, the model's probably not going to recognize that as a spear phishing attempt, right? And it will probably just generate that email for me, or will it? Like, how are you thinking about spear phishing detection, like at the model end?
So the principles of responsible AI obviously dictate that any system like that you would be using, whether it was, an open LLM like ChatGPT or something like that, should, as you say, reject. I'm not writing your spear phishing emails for you. Like, no. Obviously, you can continue to kind of manipulate and ask for more granular, more specific things that would result potentially in that model giving you something that you could probably augment yourself to create. That said, that isn't that different from what people can do today without AI. And so to me, the creation of the body of the social engineering is not really that compelling when it comes to AI. The thing that's compelling to me when it comes to spear phishing, as an example, is the scale. If you can leverage sending huge volumes, or you can be very targeted and tactical and do really great reconnaissance and research on your targets, to me, that is the higher priority of thinking about these campaigns and these threats versus an AI is going to create the body of the email for me.
Mm.
It might take an AI 2 minutes to create the body of that email, and it might take you 8 minutes. And yes, the AI is much faster, but you can use that same email hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of times.
I'm kind of surprised at that because, you know, we've been writing a lot in the last 6 months about Scattered Spider, this group of, I don't know, crime teens, for lack of a better word, right?
Like, don't let them hear you say that.
I don't think they listen, but I don't know, we'll see. But and one of their real talents is in social engineering, right? And one of the things that really enables that is their use of vernacular English. And it would seem to me like if I'm a North Korean hacker, I might be really skilled at like writing a good exploit, but what I'm not going to be good at is vernacular English, but I can probably get a large language model to be pretty good at vernacular English for me. And that could be something that would really level up my game.
I'm still stuck on the hacker teens.
Crime teens.
Crime teens. Oh dear, the crime teens. So we refer to that actor as Octotempest. And yes, I think that generally in the threat research community.
Oh, sorry. Octotempest is Scattered Spider for you?
Yes.
Okay.
Those are what we consider generally overlapping, but not necessarily equivalent group. We track them by that name. And I think that most people in the threat research community would agree that their native English capability is quite a little superpower for them.
Yeah.
It's really been something that has helped them. But I'll share something else with you, actually. It is quite a bit of a superpower for threat researchers as well, because there is no language barrier that they have to deal with when analysts are looking at that work. So a threat actor that speaks a different language than the analyst, that creates a barrier that has to be translated and thought about, and how are we doing, is it cultural? And we have vast teams of people that pair with analysts at Microsoft that have language and culture and background skills to help them navigate doing research on threat actors that are not native to that researcher. But in this case, the threat actor and the research community are very much on the same wavelength, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of cultural language, et cetera. And so that's actually a superpower for us. It's working great for them, but it also makes things faster for researchers, which I think is really cool. So when we think about the AI creation of social engineering material, I think that what we've got to do is look to technology. I am not a big fan of train people better. I think we've got to use technology to protect people better. We've got to use technology to, detect things better. And that's really going to be the key. And within Microsoft, we are heavily AI and machine learning focused when it comes to email detection. That is a massive part of our capability to do threat detection in email. We've been using AI and ML for years and years and years in that domain. So the key is going to be a layered look at those emails, like body, attachment, URLs, origins, pulling all of those things together, doing it at speed and scale. It's a tough thing. I mean, email is one of the weirdest technologies that you will come across. I mean, it's wild. It's like just random people can send you anything at any time. There really aren't a lot of other technologies that. And it's so open. It's a difficult problem, but I do think that we've got to use technology to be better about blocking that stuff. We've got to use it to be better detection, better interception, and then create threat intelligence based off of that. And that, I think, will end up being what wins that race.
Yeah. So what's the current state of defensive AI tools for the problems that we're talking about? Spear phishing. How's that going? You're on the front lines of this problem. How is it?
I am sometimes very blown away by how good it is. And then I also see plenty of areas for improvement. It's not perfect. I mean, every time you use one of the copilots or you use any of those products out there, it says, don't forget, AI is not perfect. And I think that we definitely are at that place where, you know, there's going to be areas that we will need to catch up on. But the thing to remember is that's true about hard-coded static detection too. There's always this, oh, the threat actors are getting around it. Change your models or change your rules or change your, oh, they got around it that way. And those first detected new TTPs are the key. And with AI and ML, we are able to detect them faster than we could otherwise. And so I think that that's really the key, is that, you know, AI and ML really help go fast. Like, it's all about going faster. And when it comes to detection, the earlier you can get it, the faster you can get it, the better you'll be.
How are you using AI in your kind of day-to-day job?
In my job or my personal life?
Oh, let's do both. Let's do job and then let's do personal life.
Okay. So I use one of the AI tools every single day at work.
Okay.
Primarily because I have been at Microsoft a year, and one of the things that attracted me to it was the Microsoft threat intelligence capability. And that is all in Copilot. Mm. So if I want to know about a particular threat actor group, if I want to know about a TTP, if I want to know about reputation or an IP address or a particular piece of code or vuln or anything, I can go to Copilot and ask it, and it'll give me all of that information. And I love that. And of course, I take my frustrated tone emails and I ask it to make them friendly tone emails. please write this to me really nice. So
it does that for you?
Of course. Yes, of course it does. Outlook Copilot's great for that.
I've learned to use just exclamation points. So yeah, my emails are getting friendlier.
You need to be able to throw some emojis in there. Yeah. You can ask it to do that too. Like, I need a lot of emojis for this one. So I definitely use it for communication and research, which I think are really great applications. And then in my personal life, I have used it for every single thing you can imagine. I had a party and I asked it to make themed drinks and a themed grocery list and give me recipes and tell me what I needed to do. And I just blindly followed the party directions that ChatGPT gave me. And it was a great party celebrating celebration of life for Jimmy Buffett when he passed.
Oh, wow. So
we had margaritas. And
it was a margarita, right?
Yeah, the whole thing. Yeah. Tiny cheeseburgers, everything. But I think that we are seeing an evolution, right? We really are seeing the Industrial Revolution. Mm. We're seeing the early days of the Industrial Revolution. We're seeing the early days of, like, the washing machine. This is a shift in technology and culture that nobody really knows what's going to happen. And that's why things like responsible AI, we have a huge AI red teaming program at Microsoft. I mean, it is really, really, really fascinating what those AI red team folks are working on. We have the first AI bug bounty. If you find a bug in AI, we have a bug bounty program for that. Those are the things that are going to keep us focused and responsible and using these AI technologies to the best of ourselves every day.
Last question I want to ask you about is kind of open versus closed models. It feels like there's almost like a tribal debate or tribal camps that are being developed in like the AI community versus on like open versus closed source models. You know, that closed source models, you know, they address some of the kind of existential threats that we face. And then there's, you know, the open camp that really wants to democratize these tools and make them available to everyone. I'm curious how you think about that open versus closed debate, if you have strong feelings about it, if you think there's, you know, compelling reasons to kind of try to push more in one direction or another, if you feel kind of particular risks regarding either or both of the approaches.
I think if you've ever read The Cathedral and the Bazaar, we are bumping up into that idea so much more, which is this idea of like walled garden versus the everyone can contribute, everyone can be a part of it. It's so wide open for everyone. And I think, I mean, that debate is decades old, right? Are we open or are we closed? Are we really, really well monitored and curated and perfected? Or are we kind of Wild West shoot from the hip? I think that there has to be a place for both to weave together and live in the way that truly we do now with enterprise software, open source software, and those things coming together to give us, you know, a better than themselves kind of sum of its parts situation, which I think we can do. That said, I think as a researcher, the open models are what's probably going to bring in more innovation and more new things to look at. But at the same time, just with open source software, there are some pitfalls there. It's like a closed model can be perfectly handled and taken care of and owned by a caretaker and have full responsibility for it, which in some ways we don't always see with things that are open. So I think it just depends. And I mean, I love a bitter rivalry, so I will dig into that and both sides of that issue as much as I possibly can.
All right, beautiful. That's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Safe Mode, a weekly podcast on cybersecurity and digital privacy brought to you by CyberScoop. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and a review and share it with your friends, your mom, your dad. Nobody wants to get hacked. To find out more information or to contact me, your host, please visit cyberscoop.com.